So, in his words, it would be a pivotal moment in human history if Africa harnessed graphene before anyone else. My God. And obviously, if you know me, I'm not just going to leave that and just carry on like nothing happened, right? I'm going to take that and run with it to the ends of the earth. So what we're going to do in this podcast is talk everything graphene, but focus on the African continent. What would it mean if Africa harnessed this piece of technology, this idea, this whatever it is, this material, before everyone else? And harnessed, the way I'm thinking about it is, if it got to the point where it could be used in you know, production, industry, you know, it could be used as part of, you know, other materials, cars, trains, airplanes, whatever it is, right? What would that mean? That's number one. What would it mean if Africa harnessed this technology before everyone else? Number two, what frameworks need to be in place to make this possible, right? So I sent a link to a story that I wrote to someone called Sean that you will hear from later in this interview. I wanted some feedback on the story. The story is called Levitation, and it's this sort of Steve Jobs style product presentation where there's this person in the story. He's the head of operations. He unveils this high-speed train. It's a tour train, high-speed tour train that connects African cities and towns, and it's this amazing thing, right? So I sent him this story, and this company in the story, Levitation, has partnered with a number of different companies. So one of the companies that he partnered with is called Vibranium Industries, and the feedback from Sean was he felt like the realism in the story was a bit limiting to him by using that name, Vibranium. He felt it'd be better to maybe, you know, go with a real world material, right? And obviously I have my own reasons for choosing the names that I did, and that was feedback that he gave that I thought was quite useful, because he went on to then suggest using or thinking about using graphene. I'm like, graphene? What's that? That thing that I learned in chemistry class that I can only vaguely remember at this point, way back in the day. So obviously the last few days I've been downloading boatloads of podcasts, watching videos, reading articles and all sorts of things just to learn more about this graphene thing. And obviously there's tons of videos, right? So I'm immersed in this world and I thought, hey, let's have a discussion about graphene. But let's talk about it from the context of Africa, right? If you put those two words together, graphene and Africa, put it into Google, right? Actually, let me do that right now, see what comes up. I bet you it's not going to be, let's see what comes up. Okay, I see something about water filtration, which is cool. Company just applied graphene materials, signs some kind of distribution with a South African. Okay, cool. I mean, yeah, let's not get into this too much, but what I was interested in was, you know, having a discussion about graphene. Because even if you go look at all the companies that are producing graphene, mining graphene, you know, distributing graphene, creating different materials, R&D in graphene, the percentage of them that are African are like, It's not looking good. The money is not in, you know, the region is not putting that much money into it, which obviously is not that big of a surprise. But I'm like, yo, Sean, let's talk about this. Let's record it. And he was also very interested in recording something as well. So we met up today and recorded this episode. Let's see. Three major things that we're going to talk about. What would it mean for Africa to harness this technology? Right? What frameworks need to be in place to make this possible? And what does harness even mean? So we had a discussion about different aspects of the graphene and materials industry. So those that are producing it, those that are mining it, etc., right? And we also touched on, we ended the conversation with, you know, a talk about the education industry, the education system, because he lived and he spent some time in Egypt, so we talked a bit about education and what would need to change in education for the region to really sort of, I guess, prosper, right? So here's Sean, and here's our discussion. Also, a 10-page disclaimer is needed at this point. None of us are experts in the field of graphene production or anything to do with graphene or physics or any of that. You know, we're basically coming at this from the perspective of just, you know, very engaged, very excited bystanders, if you will. None of us are actively involved in anything to do with it. We're just, you know, things that I've heard, things that I've read, things that I've watched. So yeah, if we get anything wrong, don't be mad, okay? We're trying. We're trying our best, all right?
Right, so my name is Sean Edge, and I have a degree in Arabic and Middle Eastern studies. I've lived in the Middle East for about 10 years. I was born in South Africa. I moved to the UK when I was 5, but I've got half of my family still in South Africa. I've lived in the UK, obviously, since I was 5, but I grew up in a single-parent council house, so it's a working-class background. I did eventually got my degree in Arabic and Middle Eastern studies, like I said. I became a teacher, to teach training, and then I did a master's degree in security, terrorism, and insurgency last year, based mainly on my experience in the Middle East and what I'd seen there. And now I'm currently doing a PhD in education, specifically on how diversity is implemented in the curriculum. So, yeah.
That's in which curriculum? Specifically?
In teaching curriculum, so primary and secondary curriculum.
Okay. In the UK?
In the UK, but I mean, it could end up sprawling to other places, like comparatively, but generally it's going to be within the UK national curriculum. But in terms of kind of education, the reason why I teach what I teach is I'm one of these people who's very, very interested in everything. And I don't profess to know a lot about one thing, like be an expert at one thing, but I generally know quite a lot about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And because I read just stuff everywhere, which is mad, which is how I found out about the graphene thing. So yeah. And I think the Africa side of things is, again, because I've still got half my family over there, I visit quite a lot, and it frustrates me, infuriates me when I see things like companies, well, not companies, charities that are going to try and give Africans shoes because Africans don't have shoes, so they need shoes.
Or
give a man a fish and he can feed his family, but give him a net and he can feed everyone. It's like, well, they know how to make nets. They fucking invented nets. Fuck off. It's keeping people down by pretending that they are still children. The continuous nature of kind of underestimating and underdefining the intellect of an entire group of people in an entire continent that they don't do for any of the other continents, not even South America or Asia, which are equally as developing. If you look at the states of those continents, it is a fundamental fact that they only ever talk about Africa from a developing aspect, from a they're not anywhere near as capable as us.
No.
They never talk about developing into what, from what to what.
What is the
end focus according to them? Is developing mean developing into like Europe or America? Because I can show you Chicago and I can show you Detroit, and that might be a bit of a problem. So inner city London or inner city Birmingham, you can't really say developing into what in comparison to Johannesburg or in comparison to Cairo, things like that. It's hugely problematic to me. So, which brings us on to our questions of development in Africa.
I just wanted to start with like graphene.
Do you want a bit of a description of what graphene is?
For those that don't really know what it is, what is it from what you understand?
From what I understand, graphene is a future technology or a future material. What's been described as a super material.
Mm-hmm.
It is created by using graphite, which mm-hmm. is the metal that you get in your pencils,
mm-hmm.
to create a superconducting material that is incredibly strong, incredibly light, so it's supposedly stronger than iron or steel, as light as carbon fiber,
mm-hmm.
that is a superconductor that can be used to create or help to create new technologies, future technologies,
mm-hmm.
that we as the world will be using 10, 20, 30 years in the future.
Mm.
It's very difficult to make at the moment, because at the moment, as far as I'm aware, they can only make small amounts of it, because it is time consuming and expensive to be able to produce
mm.
in any large quantity. Mm. So its actual application is a bit of a problem right now, but mm. once someone figures out how to do it
mm.
from a large scale,
mm-hmm.
whether it's through mining of graphite and then using that, or having an army of children with pencils rubbing it on sellotape, it depends on how they want to do it, but yeah, once it becomes mass producible, then that would be the game changer, according to most of what I know about graphite and graphene.
I'm guessing graphite is not the only way to make
source
it.
Of it. No. Well, it's probably the easiest way to make it,
hmm.
in that both graphite and graphene are carbon materials,
hmm.
in the same way that diamond is a carbon material.
Hmm.
It just depends on the atomic structure that it's set out at.
Hmm.
So graphite is already set up in what would be seen as almost like a cube-like atomic structure.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can force that to be layered in a grid pattern, that's what graphene is. Whereas if you have it too tightly compact,
mm.
then that's what diamond is. And diamond isn't useful as a material for construction because it's too difficult to break or use or can't conduct anything.
Mm.
And if it's too open, atomic structure, then that's coal. Coal's good for burning, but mm. other than that, you can't build on top of it. It's going to crumble.
Mm.
So you need it to have a grid-like structure, which mm. is what graphene creates, to mm. give it its strength, but also because it's carbon, it is light, and that's the point of it.
I haven't heard it explained like that before, and that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So from one of the texts that you sent, based on the story that I sent to you, the levitation story of how one of the pieces of feedback that you gave was that you thought the story would be a bit more impactful if it drew more on like real world materials.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we've spoken about this before, the use of the idea of vibranium
mm.
coming very much from the zeitgeist of pop culture at the moment with
mm-hmm.
Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and again, we've spoken about this, Black Panther comes from a very Afro-American centric
mm-hmm.
ideology, and the idea of an African nation having a super material that is native to their country
mm.
that only they can then use, which is vibranium,
mm.
and then that creates this kind of weirdly mythical society that still has very European-centric ideas of what Africa is, with the animal motifs and that sort of thing,
yeah.
but utilizes it to create a new kind of future society.
Mm.
That's all well and good, but when we're talking about Afrofuturism,
mm-hmm.
the actual idea of what could happen really in Africa,
mm-hmm.
we do need to ground it more on real things like graphene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, we were talking about, and we'll go back into it again, about nuclear fusion,
mm.
like technology and engineering in Africa in general.
Mm.
And I think also putting it into context of real African cultures
mm-hmm.
within different countries
mm-hmm.
and not into using kind of like a blast or creation that the Americans created representing their ideology of what Africanism is,
mm.
if you see what I mean.
But graphene itself, though, wasn't it? It was, I guess, discovered or whatever at what, Manchester University?
Yeah. Like, so, but I mean, it was, but it's still something that is creatable and has always been creatable. We just had to learn how to create it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's not like Avatar's unobtainium. Or something that is like an invisible
mm.
magical property that can be gotten.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that actually can be made.
Okay.
It just needs to be made
mm.
in an easy and sellable way,
okay.
which is the important thing.
So diving right into it, what would you, in your view, what would it mean for Africa to harness this technology? Like, how do you interpret that?
If Africa were able to harness it,
mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, you'd need to have a section of Africa, an African country or an African city with a university or something like that, would be willing to put the time and energy and effort into creating it, first of all. And then putting the money and the time and the energy into having it manufactured and produced.
Mm.
If that were all feasible, and that is perfectly feasible in the more industrialized countries of Africa, so Nigeria, South Africa, Egypt, even to other extents, part of Tanzania and Ethiopia, or those places like that.
Mm.
It would mean that they'd suddenly have an ability to create a material that the whole world wanted.
Mm.
That is not the same as diamonds or gold, because those things are luxury things that are only used for jewellery.
Mm.
This time they'd have a material that is necessarily usable for building construction, for technology construction, for changing the entire life frame of how the world works.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a little bit like Africa creating electricity before anyone else did. That the feasible aspects of how it could change society around the world is probably immeasurable if it were to be done. But that would be the problem of how it would be created in Africa and whichever society did then create it.
So looking at like the different I guess, what would you call it, different kinds of
uses, honestly.
Yeah, not even uses, so having producers, having people that mine it, where do you think the value comes from?
Well, as we've always seen with most countries that maintain or have materials that are wanted, the mining of the thing is very rarely where the money comes from. So it's the production side of it that maintains the amount of money that comes into it. So if you look at it from a point of view of oil, oil is created, it's mined, it's dug out from the ground in Saudi Arabia, but the amount of money that is made from it is kept within the companies of Shell or Texaco or BP, for example. So it's the widespread use of it. The money is from there. If you, for example, are a plastic producer, you buy the oil and then you use that crude oil to create the polycarbons that then create the plastics. So it's your production of it that then brings value to the use of plastic. The intrinsic getting the oil out of the ground isn't where the value is, because oil is just crushed up ancient animals. What the value is how it's used, the production of it. So that's where that comes from.
No, go on.
So that's where things like graphene's production, and then it's being harnessed, its use is important, because then if it's used in conjunction with new emerging other technologies, like, for example, nuclear fusion, with the energy that you'd need to be able to use graphene in any meaningful way, for example, transport, then you'd need a large amount of energy to keep it moving. Whereas if you would combine it with fossil fuel technology, you could still do stuff with it, but that's kind of taking away from the future aspect of what graphene could be in comparison to what iron is or what steel is.
What do you think it could become?
I mean, if you speak to technologists, they'll say it can come from anything from inlining of clothing, so that you could literally charge your phone while you're walking, to what your phone is actually made out of, to what your homes are made out of, to what the streets are made out of. I mean, they claim that it could be used for everything and anything. My argument for that would be is there's not enough graphite in the world to create an entire world of graphene. I think realistically, it will probably be used and manufactured for transport, high-speed travel. So that could include space travel. Companies like SpaceX and Tesla would very much want to look into that. Cars would probably look at it, because it would increase the strength and the durability of cars while decreasing the weight. Airplanes, those sorts of things. It's probably far more likely to be used in transport first than many other things. And then it would possibly be used within technologies like phones or those sorts of things afterwards.
Okay. From your perspective as well, what kind of, I guess we've talked about this a little bit, but what kind of frameworks do you think will need to be in place for that to actually happen?
Within Africa or within the world?
So for Africa to take advantage of this technology, this material, whatever. So
First of all, you'd have to look at the places that where it could be mined from.
Mm-hmm.
So the sources of graphite in Africa, you're probably looking along the West African regions,
because mm-hmm.
that tends to be where you get your coal sinks, what are called your carbon sinks.
Mm.
So that's where there were rainforests for millennia, mm. and they've eventually been buried and buried and buried. So you're going to get graphite in those regions.
Mm.
So within those regions, you then have to have mining infrastructure put into place.
Mm-hmm.
These would have to be clean mining infrastructures, because you don't want your people dying from trying to dig out graphene or graphite.
Mm.
Mm. Let's get this straight. It's graphite they dig out, not graphene. They create graphene from graphite.
Mm.
Once you've got that, then you have to have the production company, if it were owned by African nation, like, let's say, Sierra Leone.
Mm-hmm.
Sierra Leone would actually be quite a good example of us had taken a very, very poor country and having it find something that's worth so much,
mm-hmm.
to harness something that's worth so much.
Mm.
If they were then able to take that graphene, mm-hmm. graphite, and then produce it into graphene,
mm-hmm.
they would then need to create distribution infrastructures of how to sell it to and who to sell it to and how to get the wealth back and spread that back into the infrastructure of the country around it,
mm-hmm.
in order to maintain the kind of hegemony of their power over it.
Mm.
Because if they only have the as with diamonds,
mm-hmm.
they only have the mines, the mines will get bought by outside peoples,
mm.
who will pay off presidents or whoever in order to get it.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Mm.
You need a whole country focus, a whole governmental focus on maintaining a kind of national, almost a national monopoly,
mm.
on the creation of it, so that it can be sold to the rest of the world.
On the creation or the mining? Not the mining.
Both. It has to, the mining of it, if they only have the national monopoly on the mining,
mm-hmm.
which they do, because that's how they get bought out by other companies in other countries,
mm-hmm.
in order to sell the diamonds to other countries. Whereas if they have a national monopoly on the production of it and
mm-hmm.
the use of it,
mm-hmm.
then they can maintain the wealth generated from it within their own country.
Mm.
Where that wealth would then be used is a bit of a problem, because Africa's historically had an issue with European-like socialist governments, because they've distrusted it, because that's what caused half the issues in Africa today. So
is what?
With the idea of this, I read this very recently,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of African nations,
mm-hmm.
in the state that they are now,
mm-hmm.
are in the state they are now because countries like France and Britain and Europe,
mm-hmm.
and Europe, France and Britain,
mm-hmm.
and Germany and Italy and
mm-hmm.
places, put them like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a natural distrust, for example, in countries like Zimbabwe,
mm-hmm.
of socialist democratic government styles,
mm.
because that's what made the problems to begin with.
Mm.
It's too European.
Mm. Oh,
do you
yeah.
see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, then there's another issue that comes along with that, because then you have tribalism, then fighting against an imperialist ideology and those sorts of things.
Mm.
What you need is a country that is relatively stable democratically to enable the outflow of currency to reach the rest of the people.
Mm.
So countries that haven't changed hugely in the period of their history would then be something like Egypt, even though they have a military country, that
mm-hmm.
a military dictatorship in place.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't, their country's borders, their entire social infrastructure has never really been outlined by a European nation.
Mm.
So how they choose to spend their wealth is very much along the cultural lines that they've always spent their wealth.
Mm.
They're not necessarily by any means a democratic country, so then you'd have to think of an African state that would be a lot more socialist democratic, that would share the wealth with a lot more of its people.
Mm.
That would be the benefits of it, but then again, we still need to talk about how the energy production that we'd need to be able to use it, which would then come into things like the nuclear fusion.
Mm-mm-mm.
But again, this is the problem that we were talking about earlier, is the issue of technology, manufacturing, engineering, and Africa. If you type those things into Google,
yeah,
you don't find anything. And I think this is connected to something else I said to you, like, for example, the boy from Zambia,
yeah.
who harnessed the wind. There's a film about it called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind.
Hmm.
It's a really good film, in fact.
Hmm.
But basically, he managed to create his own wind turbines in order to pump water around his fields.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into a little bit in the film in that the reason there's such a big problem with flooding and then drought
mm-hmm.
in Zambia,
mm-hmm.
it's not Zambia, it's Mozambique. is because large amounts of the land had been bought by tobacco plantations that then cut down most of the forests that were there and planted tobacco. But it was the forests that were maintaining the structure of the land so that when it rained, it wouldn't flood. So it's all of these problems that are coming into place. Anyway, that young man created these wind turbines, and the same kind of thing happened as with a few other people I've heard of, where he's rewarded for his ingenuity by being sent, first of all, to South Africa to finish school in a private school in South Africa, and then being sent to America to go and study at MIT, whereupon he's very likely to probably stay. Because why wouldn't he? He's now not living on a very poor farm in Mozambique. This is a problem that Africa tends to have. It's a brain drain through the fact that they can see a better life for themselves, and they'll give it a better life for themselves the moment they show any form of ingenuity. So give your ingenuity to America, give your ingenuity to Europe, don't give it to the country you're from. Again, I've worked in countries like Egypt and Morocco, where I've met taxi drivers who were trained lawyers or radiologists, but in their own language and their own culture, which meant it was worth nothing. So they were stuck being taxi drivers because they made more money doing it. That's a problem. This is a cultural problem that we've got to face in the whole of Africa. That Morocco, for example, the lottery, the national lottery for Morocco at the time when I was there, so this was 2004, was to win a green card for America.
The what lottery? The
national lottery.
Okay.
The Moroccan national lottery prize was to win a green card for America.
Jeez.
So your prize was to not have to be a Moroccan anymore. What does that say about the social cultural ideology of a country? It's mental to me, and it's not the only place that behaves in that way. And it doesn't make it makes sense, because the vast amount of Western culture that is spread around the world is obviously American. And I'm not trying to be anti-American in this situation. But if you want nations to develop themselves, they need to, A, stop being treated like children. B, you can't constantly give them handouts, because then you create economies of need and economies based on constant gratification from help. You need to say, if they are really going through something that does need aid, you can't tell them they have to pay it back 20 years later. Because it's then not charity.
With interest.
Yeah. Like, how is it charity if you're telling them they have to pay it back with interest?
No.
And then the French have done that a number of times. But these are all... And then we have to address the problem of education in Africa, of being the middle classes and the upper classes sending their children to European-languaged schools. So they go to the International British School of, or the International French School of, or the International American School of. But the focus is not on building their own culture. Building their own ability to actually work for themselves. Having said that, with the very large amount of West African people moving to Britain at the moment, whose children are overperforming in schools, is evident, and it's hopeful that perhaps they then would go back and take that knowledge back to their own country.
Yeah.
But will it become similar to how it's becoming in the UAE, where the most spoken language amongst the natives now is English? Quite possibly. So again, it's still the destruction of their own culture. These are all issues that come into play.
Because it's almost like once you go live, say, somewhere here, you get used to this environment. You don't want to go back and then...
Absolutely. And I think, Asian friends of mine have said this, especially if they were born here or their parents were born here in their second or third generation. They go back to Pakistan or India to visit family, and they don't like it very much because it's not what they're used to. They either don't even speak the language very well. Why would they? Because they are British. But it's still that kind of that feeling of everything is being drained from those other places. The argument is, of course, those were all colonial places that were colonised by Britain, so you can't blame those people from then coming back to the coloniser and taking back from the coloniser. Sure. But then take it back to where your family are from and help them build back. Not saying you need to leave, but at least go back there on holiday and set up schools or put money into foundations for education or further infrastructure. A friend of mine, Irfan's constantly been asked by his family to set up businesses in Pakistan. He'd rather go to live in Miami. So, and it's this kind of, it's an odd thing.
Which region of the continent would you say if it was harnessed there, if it was, if they managed to produce it there, it would benefit, say, the entire continent.
Right.
Because I think if you have only one part of the region that's doing well and everyone else is not doing great, then...
I mean, there are examples of the African Union and members of the African Union helping each other out.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Akala, who I was listening to on a podcast very recently, was saying that South Africa has put a lot of money into having ancient African writings from West Africa translated into English and other languages so that we can actually start documenting older African history, because it exists. So that's an example of a larger, more powerful African nation actually spending some of its money for African benefit, for pan-African benefit.
Mm.
I think you'd need a country, first of all, that isn't necessarily gripped by a lot of internal problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be great for Africa if a country like Nigeria got it, because of the large amounts of tribal influences and the large amount of different language spoken influences in that country causes issues, and then there'd be backfighting and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be brilliant if they got it, but it just depends. To help a whole of Pan-Africa, maybe somewhere a little bit more like Cameroon, somewhere like Tanzania, somewhere like Ethiopia, where they've already got a fairly stable, structured environment for themselves anyway. And then the benefit of having that technology develop it within their nation would then help to spread out. Again, we've spoken about a problem, obviously, if a nation like that, which is fairly stable and fairly peaceful, develops that sort of technology, would it stay fairly peaceful, peaceful and stable? Because other nations, including European American or Asian nations, might try and take it. That's always the problem too. So it's all these kind of...
Can you say more... I like what you were saying about the production thing, like producing. Can you say more about that? Because the article that I was referencing, I'll link it somewhere in the notes and stuff, grapheneinfo.com. And they break down like all the different companies in the graphene industry. So like graphene producers, developers, graphene manufacturing equipment, graphene mining, and then related companies to all of these.
Yeah.
Say more about production.
So, I mean, I don't profess to be an expert in graphene at all,
or
in graphene production.
None of us are.
But I think from graphene production, to take it away from the kind of the Pangaea of science that seems to see it as the best thing that could ever be invented by anyone ever, I think realistically the production side of things would go into, like I say, transport. You could feasibly use it, being as it's supposed to be a superconductor, as well as because of its structure and things. You could feasibly use it for road construction. There was something I saw a few years ago about the idea of turning roads into solar panels. So the whole road is a solar panel. And if you imagine the entire of Arizona and all of its road systems being solar panels, the amount of energy you would get from that. You could feasibly use something like graphene in the production of those sorts of solar panels. A major issue with solar panel construction at the moment is the durability of the panels themselves and the ability to keep the energy, or to store the energy, or store enough energy to actually make any variable difference. As for an example, you can cover the whole of your roof in solar panels at the moment, and the best you will do is over a year get enough energy to offset the amount of money you cost for the amount of year to make to buy the energy off an electricity producer. Do you see what I mean? So the solar panel industry at the moment is not where it could be. With something like graphene, you could use it very much to help bolster or even improve that structure. So solar energy would be a big one. You could use it for even within shipping. I mean, at the moment we still have ships that then still spill oil if they have damage. Very rarely gets reported nowadays because they don't want a lot of it coming onto the things. But if they were built from a stronger, lighter material, you've got less chance of it then being damaged. As opposed to communication technology, like I say, some people have said you could use it in the internals of clothing, or you could use it for telephones, or the movement forward of communication technology. But I still think, you know, we need to remember that just like with oil, graphite is a finite resource. You can't easily make graphite just with coal without it becoming a diamond or becoming something else. So you need to figure out how much you've got and then what you're going to use it for. And equally, you don't want the entirety of the, all the carbon sinks of the world, so West Africa or the Amazon rainforest, being dug up just for graphite, which is another danger. And one problem that humanity has always had is that we find a substance or a material that we like and suddenly destroy everything for it. Palm oil is an even example of that right now, and it's only used in chocolate. So it's a big head scratcher, I think, for a lot of people, how it works out.
Let's bring us back to education before we wrap it up.
Yeah.
Let's say there was someone like some kind of, like, say at the African Union level, that said, okay, we're going to put forward some kind of, I don't know, initiative to revamp
the education system.
Yeah. So that we can take advantage of some of these sort of leading technologies. We don't want to be behind everyone catching up 10 years later. What would you say will need to change?
Well,
if you were, let's say you were the advisor for this person.
All I can give you is what I would plan to do.
Right.
Which is a fantasy I've had in my head.
Uh-huh.
So let's say you take the International School of, the British International School of Cairo. There is actually a school called that, but I'm trying to just use any name that's called British International or International School of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's a private school.
Right.
The parents of that school pay up to, what, 30,000 a year for their child.
30,000
to be in that school. Pounds.
Jeez.
So that's not all those. I'm not saying that's true for that specific school, but for a lot of very high-level international schools, it
that's
is.
The,
Now, imagine you've got 30 kids in a class, and then you've got five of those classes. So it's 30 kids in a year two class, and you've got five year two classes. I'm not even going to be bothered to work out how much money that is coming on from just from year two, yearly, right? That money goes somewhere. It's a private school, so at the moment that money goes into the hands of whoever owns that school. Let's say that the schools were nationalized to an extent that they are owned by government, but they're still kept private, so that they, the teachers still have the European teachers still have the benefits of going to work there because it's tax free and they get their housing and they get good pay. But the money that comes into the school gets taken by the government and gets spent on national schools. So that a national school is literally, or 10 national schools are literally funded by one international school. What you could then have, for example, in a developing country like the outskirts, or developing areas like the outskirts of Egypt, you could then say, this school is free to attend because it's being funded by this large international school. So the parents don't have to pay to send their child to the school. Conversely, what you could do is you could also say, with the money that they're getting from this international school, for this smaller school in the rural area, is also feed the children. So the parents don't have to worry about getting food for that child during the day when they're out. Which then takes away the onus of the parent thinking it's better to keep the child at home because then they can help us work to get the growth of food so that we can continue to live. It actually helps us send the child to school and we don't have to pay for it and we don't have to feed them while they're at school. So it gives them a kind of benefit far more than just education's good to allow their kids to be sent to school. This is another example of the boy who harnessed the wind that I was talking about. He wanted to go to school to learn science, but his parents couldn't afford to send him to school because every school there is pay. Because school is not nationalized in a lot of these countries. So if all of the schools are nationalized and all of the smaller, low-level schools are funded by the high-profile, big international schools, you then enable an infrastructure of education to be spread throughout the country. Then what you do is you ask people from these bigger schools to go and train teachers in the lower level schools, not in how to teach in English, but in how to teach in different way. So that, for example, a lot of the schools in a lot of the rural areas that I've been to, the teachers still teach in very 1940s, 50s style of British. So they still cane, they still use blackboards, they still sit in rows. It's not what in the West we would consider modern teaching method. That doesn't mean it's wrong or bad. Mm-hmm. It just means that's the amount, that's the type of education they can do at the moment. Because their teachers have only been taught by watching other teachers as they were growing up. So what you could do is use some of the money coming from the private schools to fund teacher training in their own language and make the benefit of their own language and their own culture have a new way of teaching to get these kids want to learn their own culture and their own language. For example, a lot of Arabic-speaking kids in the Middle East don't like going to the Arabic school because the way they are taught is not the same way they are taught within the British school or the American school they attend. But if you had the same teaching methods, not the same language, but the same teaching methods used in their cultural language schools, then maybe the kids would enjoy it that much more and would appreciate their own culture and their language that much more. And that just comes with teacher training and knowing how to teach in different ways and not being reliant on the rinse and repeat attitudes of 50 years previous. To be fair, British education system is doing exactly like that nowadays too. Doesn't mean it's perfect here, but this is an idyllic idea that I would have. So you'd have the teachers trained to teach the kids in their own culture, the schools being funded by the more profitable higher up education ladder, and then what you'd then have to start bringing in over a period of 5 to 10 years is an idea that the universities in that country, which teach in their own language, will get preferential treatment, that the graduates will get preferential treatment in their own country for jobs that are infrastructure jobs rather than people who have gone to France or Canada to learn. Because then you start building up the profile of the people who have learned to do things in their own country, in their own culture, in their own language, rather than people who have had to go somewhere else to learn it. Again, that doesn't mean people shouldn't go somewhere else to learn it, because you go to places to learn specialisms. But they still need to have a kind of preferential ladder in some way to keep their culture and their language and their skills developing to a point where it's appreciated more than just it has to be British or it has to be American. Do you see what I'm getting at?
So will these be international schools then?
Well, not the funders.
Yeah, the funders are what?
Would be international schools or private schools. Because you're always, and this is a problem that socialism in this country has always had. You're always going to get wealthy, upper middle class people who want to send their kids to the better, bunny rabbit ears, schools. You're not going to get rid of that. If you did try and get rid of that, they'd send them to schools abroad. So what you do is you keep those schools, but you have those schools rather than being owned by private people. Those schools are still owned by the government, but under a bit like the Royal Mail is a private company, but is actually also owned by the government. So the private company, you think that it's a private company, but the money still goes back into government coffers at the end of the day. Similarly, you could do the similar thing with the private schools. So all the private schools could be owned by Education International, let's say, which could be a private company. Education International happens to be owned by whichever government it is that's running the country. And it has to be a government owned, but not the political party in power owned. Do you see what I mean? So it has to be civil service owned. So it doesn't matter what political party is in power, the money is still going to the government to be spent on education countrywide. See what I mean? It's not just going to be stopped because Labour's got into power or stopped because Conservatives got into power. It's a different matter. So, but to do that, that would be a massive, massive infrastructure change for any country to undertake.
Why would the international schools allow this to happen? They'll be like, no, we don't want that.
Well, the thing is, the international schools only exist on the luxury of the company, the country allowing it to. I mean, this country, England's constantly having arguments about whether private schools should be allowed to exist in this country anyway. At the moment, actually, the government's fairly happy to have private schools and then also academies because it's cheaper for the government because they want to save money. If they saw it from the converse angle of keeping those schools private to an extent but owned by the government, the money that they make could then be put into the government rather than into private hands. So, and in countries like Egypt, it's a lot easier for a government to be like, this school now belongs to us, than it is for countries like England to do that. Because it just is. So it's a way of kind of trying to use nationalist and socialist ideology, I suppose, to a benefit rather than a detriment, if that makes sense.
Where have you seen this idea?
I made this idea up. This is
where did you see?
I came up with this idea while I was working in international schools in Egypt and in the Middle East, because the vast majority of these schools are populated by local children of upper middle class families. So it might be the British International School of Cairo, but it's the vast majority of the children are Egyptian. They're not international kids.
Right.
So that's my point. Is like the kind of the educated middle classes are only being educated in British culture or American culture. They're not really being educated in their own culture. And oftentimes the kids really dislike having to do lessons in their own culture because the style of teaching isn't what they want or what they're used to. All these sorts of things. There are international schools that are Arab international schools like Shawafat, but again, their style of teaching is very specific. So these are problems. So my idea came about with the idea of what if there was one overarching company, let's call it Education International, that acted a bit like Nord Anglia, which is a large education company that buys out international schools. So a lot of international schools are owned by one company now, called Nord Anglia.
Where's that based?
It's all over the world. Nord Anglia owns British international schools.
Where's Nord Anglia?
Nord Anglia is a pan-national, I think it's in the UAE, but is a pan-national company. Even though it's owned by supposedly British people. I think it started in the UAE. But let's say that rather than it being a for-profit company like Nord Anglia, it was a company that was a overarching company, was either a charity or as a governmental company. My idea initially is actually that it's a charity. So in that, the profit that comes in from the private schools then gets funded out to smaller schools, also owned by Education International, that are local schools, meant for local people. And is given kind of incentives to send their kids to school rather than them having to pay for their kids to go to school. The school is a free school, but the teachers are trained in their own culture and their own language. That could still be a possibility. That makes it non-nationalist. But then you've got the problem of eventually the entire education system of a country being owned by a pan-national charity, which is equally problematic. So you've got these problems. I mean, unless the pan-national charity had stipulated that after a period of years those schools would be handed back to the government, but then would people be too worried that the government would stop funding it? This, that, and the other. It's always one of these problems.
So what's the difference between the big private school and the other ones that they're funding? Yeah. Well, what's the difference between them in terms of the teaching education?
Well, the major difference would be the big private school is selling itself as the British school of wherever. So the teaching is the British curriculum, it's this, that, and the other. And the middle class parents will send their kids there because that's what they see as being better, the best. Only over time can you then start phasing in the idea of actually a national school is just as good as, and eventually they'd send their kids to the national school. And then the international, you could start phasing out this ideology. Or you could start bringing into the international school that more and more of it is being taught in their own language rather than in English. So it just becomes a private school in their country rather than an international private school. But you can't do that straight away. They won't accept it straight away. If I just set up a large private school that was spoken in Arabic and taught in Arabic, I wouldn't get that many people sending their kids to it. They want their kids taught in French and English at the moment. But if you start building up the prestige of their own culture and their own language and their own country, things could start changing, but that would have to be over a period of years. See what I mean? It's like taking it's like taking a Mars bar and saying, eat this Mars bar, but then it'll make you fitter down the line. It's not a good thing to begin with, but you've got to watch the movement around. It looks nice, it tastes nice, but it's not good for you, but eventually as it moves around it would become better. But it would take years, if it ever happened at all. That would be the problem.
Well, was there anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think that's probably quite a lot. I don't know how long that's been.
40 minutes.
Yeah, I need to probably finish that.
Yeah. cool. Well, first of possibly many.
Yeah, hopefully. That'll be good. And we can just kind of come up to just different discussions about different things.
Yeah.
As we come along.
Yeah.
I think it'd be quite cool to do a talk about kind of the impact of kind of American politics, of African American politics on world culture. That'd be quite interesting. And also African American pop cultural politics on world culture would be quite interesting to look at as well.
Okay.
Mm.
Cool.
I'll tell you what I was thinking, that doesn't need to be on this, is at some point.
So thanks for joining us. In future episodes, the aim is to be as contemporary as we can. So stay tuned.